You're listening to Kingston's only campus community radio station, broadcasting 24/7, 365 on 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca. Tune in for the best local programming.
Good evening, it is 5 p.m. and this is JNYGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's News Collective, Christina Laurie, Jesse Bell, and Ellie Sturton. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines. Council has approved the development of a new special constable appointment strategy aimed at strengthening the city's response to public safety issues and enforcement challenges. Council gave the green light at their June 17th meeting to move forward with a plan that will seat five existing senior bylaw officers appointed as special constables. These officers would be granted limited police powers under select provincial laws, including the Trespass to Property Act, the Liquor License and Control Act, and the Safe Streets Act, to intervene in high-risk situations when police are unable to. A staff report to council cited increasing pressures in areas like encampment enforcement, large unsanctioned gatherings, and disorderly behavior on city property as the rationale for this move. These situations, often labeled high risk, frequently require immediate intervention, something current enforcement staff can't always manage without timely police support. The report emphasized that despite ongoing cooperation from Kingston Police, limited resources often result in consistent delays. Deputy Police Chief Scott Gee addressed council before the vote.
I know there's somebody in this room that know somebody, or you've called yourself, that police have been delayed getting there, and that's a reality. When I look at our board at some of our peak times, there can be 17 calls sitting there waiting for police to respond to, and those are generally level 3 and 4, priority 3 and 4 calls, but to that person calling, it's a priority 1, right? They expect police to be present, or law enforcement, or the appropriate agencies to be present. So I think this gives a little bit of an expansion for bylaw to attend and really attend some of those calls on city property, nuisance calls, noise complaints, unwanted persons, maybe targeting areas such as the downtown core. When I say targeting, I mean putting their resources down here. And it really falls down to the Trespass to Property Act and really expanding their roles for the Trespass to Property Act and how that may look. I think the future could be, this could be a strong position. Most universities and, like I said, most other municipalities like Toronto Housing, OC Transpo, they employ a large cadre of special constables because, obviously the cost of a special constable is lower, and the duties they're doing, a lot of services have tried to use private security companies, and it just hasn't been a success. And if you have your staff that are trained, invested, and stay with you, hopefully you put out a better product than a contract.
Kyle Campo, the city's manager of licensing and enforcement, underscored the need for additional tools for bylaw officers in the field.
It's not that we're going to get into these high-risk situations. We are already in them. We are well over 300 calls for encampments on a reactive high-risk scenario. We're not just focused on encampments. There's other aspects for public spaces that we're looking at where we are currently doing these duties where there are safety risks involved with them. I do feel comfortable with this program, that it's going to allow my staff the training, the abilities, to look at other aspects that helps protect them and myself and all of the city in terms of, I guess, the liabilities that we're already doing. It's not that, again, we're going into these high-risk scenarios. We are in these high-risk scenarios as we're speaking. So it does give me a level of comfort that there's regulations that governs this. There's going to be reporting mechanisms, but there's also the advanced training. Again, this is not to come out and be forceful in any aspect. This is to protect ourselves.
While the report and proponents state this is a step towards improving community safety, concerns have been expressed by the community regarding over-policing and the impact this could have on vulnerable populations, including unhoused residents and students. Eldira Balaj and Elisa Parisa. Representing the Alma Mater Society, a student association at Queen's University, brought student concerns directly to council.
Students and community members have already expressed concerns about the rising criminalization of poverty, housing insecurity, and public gathering. This model raises concerns about how it may be used to police unhoused individuals and police peaceful protesters. Authorizing senior enforcement officials to exercise police-like powers without the full accountability structures, proactive communication lines, extensive training, and community oversight that apply to sworn police officers creates a dangerous ambiguity to authority and escalation. According to our data, in 2024-2025 school year, there were zero arrests during our UDSI periods like Homecoming, FOCO, St. Patrick's Day, and Orientation Week. Yes, zero. That didn't happen because we had more enforcement. This happened because we practiced proactive collaboration between the AMS, city staff, Queens administration, bylaw officers, police liaison officers. We built trust-based campaigns that worked.
Taking all our concerns into account, we urge council to pause this recommendation, conduct meaningful public consultation with affected communities, including students, advocacy organizations, and equity-deserving groups. And finally, consider reinvesting in harm reduction approaches and civilian-led community safety programs instead of further entrenching enforcement models. As this recommendation stands, this does not seem like a step towards safety. It's a step towards over-policing. This model could potentially show distrust towards your student population, ultimately producing the opposite of the intended effect.
Relaying the concerns from community members, questions from council mainly revolved around oversight and accountability. In response, amendments were introduced by councillors Brandon Tozo and Connie Glenn. Tozo called for a report by the end of 2025 detailing the governance and enforcement framework the special constables will follow. And Glenn added a clause to ensure any expansion of the program will have to come through council again. With these amendments in place, most councillors were ready to cautiously move forward with the program. Councillors Tozo and Glenn stated the following.
Some of the points that have been risen about this issue in the community, I think, are well taken. We're not, as the chief of police once said, we're not going to police our way out of a mental health and addiction crisis. And we're not. Like, this is a tool, I think, in our toolbox that we do need to look at and take seriously. There have been times I've called bylaw in dealing with challenges in my area, and I know that they would appreciate support for X powers. And I've had constituents who called the police and had to wait out quite a length of time to deal with their issues. The delegation said it best. It's like, even if you're calling the police, it's a priority one to you. If this gives us more tools to deal with some of the challenges that we're facing as a municipality, I support it. But knowing full well that I want to know what we're getting into before this program is launched.
I was tentative about this when it came forward. And I'm still going to remain cautious, but we've put in place, I think, some solid reporting mechanisms, some double checks. One of the things that I wanted to put out there is that I have had contact from a number of members of the community who were concerned about the impact of this on the unhoused and on the encampment community. Now, once they were informed that this would be senior management from bylaw, they were comforted. And I think that this is quite a compliment to our bylaw team that they felt they were capable of doing this and doing this with discretion and with care. So based on that kind of feedback and positive response, I'm heartened to hear that the community is also supportive of this because it's going to be done well. And I trust staff to do that, but I also think we've put the correct mechanisms in place at this point in time. Council has always had the discretion to change their mind on these things. So I'm willing to see this move forward for the time being with the checkback process that it's now being put in place.
Compo also addressed the concern of increased enforcement, stressing that the program will not just be a matter of additional force.
We are always leading by being transparent, working with the community. I appreciate Councillor Glenn's comments in terms of the folks that are reaching out in terms of the encampments, because we really pride ourselves on those relationships that we're building. It's one of the key foundations that, you know, there's a lot of burnout with these types of situations. There's a lot of reoccurring conversations that we have, and we pride ourselves, and that's not going away. we're continuing to build those relationships, not with just members of the vulnerable sector, with the students, with the community in general. That's first and foremost. But I do feel comfort in the fact that we're going to be given the proper tools to be able to deal with these situations that we're already currently dealing with. We're going to be, again, focusing on getting people the proper solutions we need. And then, again, this is only for risk situations that happen when absolutely needed. This is not going out and using any kind of use of force or escalated training or tools in these situations. This is for equipping our staff with the right resources.
Despite reassurance, Councillor Jeff McLaren was the sole vote against the plan, citing concerns about both effectiveness and costs.
One of the things that I learned very quickly coming onto this council was that the Get Tough program is not necessarily the best way to do things. We're on the wrong trajectory when we talk about increasing numbers of police, budgets of police, when we should be talking about what is most beneficial for increasing the trust of those students, of those in the homeless encampments, of people on the streets, in order to get compliance and buy-in. Not just because somebody has a heavy stick or the threat of detainment or extra violence, but because they recognize it as best based on the relationships that people are creating. So I'm going to have to vote against this. It is not sustainable intellectually or from a budget perspective, I believe. Yes, we can handle it this year, maybe even next year. But it's going to become more and more expensive, and I think that money can be better used somewhere else. I believe that it's trust that we need to start developing and finding strategies for, rather than from better enforcement.
The report acknowledged potential financial impacts, including equipment, training, and possible compensation changes, but stated the program will fit within the existing 2025 budget. The motion passed 9-1, McLaren opposed. City staff will now develop a detailed implementation plan outlining training, governance, and reporting requirements. Special constables are expected to be in place by the end of the year. This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
This is Jesse Bell with your sports report for Monday, June 23rd, 2025. After a dramatic back-and-forth Game 7 that served as a microcosm of sorts for the broader series, the Oklahoma City Thunder, led by Canadians Shai Alexander and Lou Dort, took home the Larry O'Brien Trophy last night. The Indiana Pacers and the Oklahoma City Thunder had very different journeys to the NBA Finals. The 68-win Thunder were the NBA's top seed and swept their way through their first-round series against the Memphis Grizzlies, won a hard 7-game series against the Denver Nuggets, before cruising to a 5-game victory over the Minnesota Timberwolves. The Pacers, on the other hand, became renowned for their last-second playoff comebacks, led by their superstar point guard Tyrese Halliburton. The matchup between superstar point guards was one with a great deal of stylistic differences. Tyrese Halliburton is an excellent half-court operator who plays very team-friendly basketball, whereas Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is better as an isolation scorer. In terms of team philosophies, Indiana is a great offensive unit, whereas Oklahoma City is one of the best team defensive units in NBA history. This was a thrilling series from start to finish, but unfortunately, Game 7 will be forever left in the what-if category. Because early in the first quarter, superstar point guard Tyrese Halliburton suffered a pretty serious Achilles injury, not only knocking him out of the game, but possibly putting his 2026 season in jeopardy. The Oklahoma City Thunder were able to capitalize on this injury to take home the second NBA title in franchise history and the first in Oklahoma City by a score of 103-91, with Hamilton's own Shai Gilgeous-Alexander taking home Finals MVP.
The
This is the Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Beginning with Monday, June 23rd, we're going to see a daytime high of 26, but it'll feel closer to 32. As such, a heat warning has been put in place for Kingston and the surrounding area. That will continue into Tuesday, June 24th, daytime high of 29, feeling closer to 35 out in the sun. So take your time, take it easy, and stay cool. Wednesday, June 25th, it cools off ever so slightly, daytime high of 26 with cloudy conditions. And moving into Thursday, June 26th, we have a daytime high of 23, but a 60% chance of precipitation, which is expected to cool conditions slightly here in the city of Kingston. That rain will give way to thunderstorms on Friday, June 27th. Same daytime high of 23 degrees, but a 70% chance of precipitation and thunderstorms into the afternoon. We're going to see a potential for thunderstorms on Saturday, June 28th. Same daytime high of 23 and about a 60% chance of storms throughout the day. Moving towards the end of the weekend, Sunday, June 29th, conditions warm up slightly going back to 25 degrees, and we're going to see a lot of cloud cover here in the city of Kingston. And then moving into the start of next week, Monday, June 30th, daytime high of 24 degrees with a 70% chance of precipitation. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. The LaSalle Causeway's summer and fall closure schedule has been updated by Public Services and Procurement Canada. Reminder that the summer dates of the LaSalle Causeway's closure are as follows: July 1st, 6th, 13th, 20th, and 27th, August 3rd, 10th, 17th, 24th and 31st, and September 7th, the causeway will be closed from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. on each of those summer dates. As for the fall, the current dates are September 21st, October 5th, 14th and 19th, and November 2nd and 16th, the time of closure being 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. on each of those dates. Here are this week's relevant road closures. Albert Street, Princess to Mac is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Aberdeen Street, William to Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Berry Street, Queen to Colborne is closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street. Earl Street, Collingwood to Toronto is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. South Bartlett Street, Smith to Victoria is closed until August 29 for construction-related activity at 655 Princess Street. Sydenham Street, Princess to Queen is closed until October 3rd for the Sydenham Street Community Space. Victoria Street, Union to Johnson is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. And Victoria Street, Princess to North Bartlett is closed until August 29th for construction-related activity at 655 Princess Street. Here are some ongoing delays to be aware of. Abbeydon Road, middle to Highway 2, expect delays while the contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract. Bayridge Drive, Milford to Henderson, expect delays for the construction of new active transportation infrastructure and intersection upgrades. Collins Bay Road, Woodbine to Princess, expect delays while a contractor completes landscaping work on Collins Bay Road. Florida Road, Henderson to Wilton, expect delays while the contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club, expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Gardner's Road at Centennial and Creekford, expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Highway 2, Abbeydon to St. Lawrence, expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. Highway 15, Kingston Mills to Middle, expect delays for a contractor to complete work on the Highway 15 CNR overhead structure. Montreal Street at John Counter, expect delays for upgrades to the intersection including new lighting, traffic signals, lanes, paving, and signage to improve safety and efficiency for all road users and to accommodate increased traffic from the Wabin Crossing. Victoria Street and Earl Street, expect delays while a contractor mobilizes to site to start work on the second phase of reconstruction for sewer, water main, sidewalks, and road.
Now coming up are the main events happening around town this week. On Wednesday, the Ground Up Dance Festival kicks off at Lake Ontario Park. Running until July 12th, it features free performances, classes, and pop-up dance happenings around town. It's all ages and all styles. Or from 7 to 8:30 p.m., join the Fiercely OK Weekly Song Circle at Chalmers United Church. Led by Steph Druin and Paul Barton, it's a welcoming $20 drop-in for anyone who wants to sing in harmony and build community through music. No experience needed. On Thursday, the Spare Some Hope Bowl-a-thon is at Splitsville, Kingston. Sessions run from 4 to 6 p.m. and 6 to 8 p.m. with bowling, snacks, raffles, and prizes to support food and housing programs through Lionhearts, Inc. Tickets are $30 or $170 for a team of six. Also Thursday, Art Noise hosts Life Drawing from 6 to 8 p.m. with a nude male model. Doors open at 5:30 and it's a $10 drop-in open to all levels. Later, check out No Effing Rules, What's Your Talent? At La Vida Bistro Bar. Hosted by local comic Ryan James, this open mic meets talent show starts at 7 with doors at 6. Or if you're in the mood to sing, karaoke at Tiernanogue runs from 9 to midnight and it's always free and fun. On Friday, Buckle Karaoke kicks off at 9 p.m. and goes until 12:30 a.m. It's free to join and always a good time. Over at the Grad Club, the Ottawa Invasion hits the stage from 8 to 11:30 p.m. with drag stars Josephine J and MX Caligula. It's a 19-plus event full of drama, camp, and fierce performances. Tickets start at $11.98. Feeling groovy? The Pride Glide Roller Disco is on at the Memorial Center from 7 to 9 p.m. Hosted by Quad Squad and DJ Tiger Styles and photographer Liz Cooper. It's $22.63 and skate rentals are available if you book ahead. Or head to the Yoga Loft YGK for a sound immersion experience with Mihaela Sanchu from 7:30 to 8:30 p.m. Tickets are $25 for this relaxing meditative session of healing sound. On Saturday, don't miss the Island Talk speaker series at Hotel Wolf Island. From 11 a.m. to noon, journalist John Loring will speak on his new book, No Jews Live Here, exploring how fascism grows in communities. It's a free event on the waterfront patio with a signing to follow. And wrapping things up on Sunday, stroll through the AWEC Summer Pop-Up Market from 10:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. in Confederation Park. This vibrant outdoor event showcases women-led businesses with art, fashion, food, and more. It's free, festive, and open to everyone. Have a local event you would like covered on CFRC's website and our news programming? Contact us today via cfrc.ca. Hey folks, I'm Ellie Sturton, and coming up are your concerts for the week. On Wednesday, Peter Van Huffel's avant-garde quartet, Callisto, hits the RCHA from 7 to 10 p.m. Tickets are $15 at the door. Euphoria, a queer drag celebration, takes over the Grad Club at 8 p.m. with hosts Sherry Ann Hex and Blow Pony. Cover for that one is $15. Or, in Springer Market Square, enjoy free big band classics at 7 p.m. with the Taylor Donaldson Orchestra for the launch of Swingin' Summer. On Thursday, jazz trio Beats Workin' returns to the RCHA from 7 to 10 p.m. Cover is just $5. Or at the Cove Inn, catch Brock Zeman from 5 to 8 p.m. for a Roots Rock birthday show. Entry is by donation. And at the Toucan, Michelle Owen and the Works bring the Pop Rock Party from 10:30 to 2 a.m. On Friday, KPP Concerts presents Housewife Luella and Jessica Wolowicz at the Broom Factory at 7:30 p.m. Tickets are $15. At the Mansion, catch Burning Tree, The Healy Brothers, and Why Go from 8 to midnight for alt-rock, blues, and pop. Tickets are $15 at the door. Amber Humbley performs at the Opinicon from 6 to 9 p.m. as part of their free summer series. And over at the Toucan, Monic, Neon Ghost House, Echoes, and Yes Please, and the No Thank Yous take the stage from 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. Also on Friday at Base 31, Ella Be Good, a tribute to the First Lady of Song, starts at 7:30 p.m. with tickets from $39 to $59. The Spire is hosting Pretzel Logic, a Steely Dan tribute, also at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are $55.25. Outdoors in Springer Market Square, Abby Stewart performs from 7 to 8 p.m. as part of Kickin' It Country, with free line dancing beforehand. And at Tiernanogue, Tyler Brett Forks plays folk country from 9 p.m. to midnight. It's 19 plus and free. On Saturday, celebrate 12 years of the Big Fat Horn Band at the RCHA from 8 to 11 p.m. with guest Jasmine Wobodich. Tickets are $30 at the door. From 11:30 to 3:30, enjoy Saturday sessions in Confederation Park with free live sets across the genres. Or folks can catch Emma Worley and Claire Hunter at Hotel Wolf Island from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. for a free evening of folk pop. Over at McKinnon Brothers Brewery, Brass Over Tea Kettle plays from 1 to 4 p.m. with bold brass and cold beer. And if you're in the mood for a festival, day one of the Power of Positivity Musical Harvest kicks off at Line Spike Frontenac from 12 to 11 p.m. with Walks of the Earth, Chantal Kreviazik, and more. Tickets range from $99 to $400. And for the Night Owls, Sweet Pea and the Heat bring rock and blues to the Toucan from 10:30 p.m. to 2 a.m. Finally, on Sunday, head to Finkel's Shore Park for live music Sundays with Lucanus Pell at 2 p.m., Ethan Crosby at 3, and Courtney Kane at 4 p.m. And day two of the Power of Positivity Festival features Cassador, Grievous Angels, Tom Green, Kelsey Main, and the headliner, Burton Cummings, running from noon to 11 p.m. And at the Toucan, don't miss the Gertrudes from 5 to 8 p.m. for their signature Kingston sound. Have a local concert that you would like covered on CFRC's website and our news programming? Contact us today via CFRC.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear, 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear. Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present Seth W.J. Hunt's new single, Avenue B. Written during a stay in a Manhattan hotel, the track draws clear inspiration from early 2000s New York rock, particularly The Strokes with its sharp guitars and upbeat distorted rhythm. Avenue B reflects Hunt's connection to the city and tackles themes of love and having fun with friends. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Avenue B by Seth W.J. Hunt on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Did you know that New Leaf Link offers day programming for adults with developmental disabilities? We serve families in Kingston and South Frontenac. Our program focuses on arts, healthy living, and community connections, including summer camp. New Leaf Link's caring staff and talented instructors provide a place for everyone to learn together and build friendships. If you or someone you know would like to join our program, please visit newleaflink.ca for more details. Together, we can grow, connect, and belong.
Your true, true friend loves you just as you are.
Do you love playing board games? Are you looking for a place on campus to make friends in a relaxed environment? Look no further than Queen's Board Game Club. Join us for weekly Thursday game nights on campus and follow our Instagram at Queen's Board Game Club for more details.
Today on Wings, we remember feminist historian and performer Sally Roche Wagner, who died June 11, 2025, just shy of her 83rd birthday. One of her great accomplishments was rediscovering the saga of canceled U.S. women's suffrage leader Matilda Joslyn Gage.
I do historical performance. I perform as Matilda Joslyn Gage, and I perform as Elizabeth Cady Stanton. I will never perform as Susan B. Anthony because I don't respect her sufficiently to call forth her spirit.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Sally Roche Wagner was one of the first scholars to study and teach women's studies in the U.S. She is also known for performances in which she impersonates founding 19th century feminists. On the 150th anniversary of the meeting that launched the women's rights movement in Seneca Falls, New York, Wagner talked to Wings reporter Elaine Clift. Among her remarks was a surprising revelation about our most famous founding suffragist, Susan B. Anthony, whose face is memorialized on the U.S. dollar coin.
When I read Matilda Joslyn Gage calling Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton traitors to the movement, had I been a trained academic historian, I would have said, I know that's not true. This is some crackpot who's just a malcontent. We can just discard her and go on with the real story and the real history. But having been trained in the feminist movement, especially in those early days when there were axioms that we lived with, one of them was the personal is political. Another one is if a woman says something, it's to be believed. And what we know now is that sometimes if women have been victimized so terribly, they may have the place wrong and the details wrong, but the ultimate truth of what they're speaking may be far deeper and more painful and troubled. Out of that training, I knew that there was truth there, and I knew that it would take me years and years of study to find the truth of what Matilda Joslyn Gage was saying. But I felt her integrity strong enough that I wanted to find out what it was she was talking about. That was in 1973. It's now 1998. I have a fairly good fix on the answer to what she was meaning.
There are a lot of people who won't know who Gage was. Can you talk about her in the context of the women's movement? Because most people do know something about Stanton and
Anthony.
They were called the trio or the triumvirate. The three names linked together in the history of women's suffrage will live on in the hearts of posterity, was one of the statements made about them. They shared leadership positions in the National Women's Suffrage Association, president, vice president, chair of the executive committee. They were the three minds behind the movement. Stanton was the writer, Anthony was the activist and organizer, and Gage was in fact both. For example, when they presented the Declaration of Rights of Women in 1876, Gage and Stanton penned that declaration, and Gage and Anthony presented it illegally. Gage was on both parts of that. The reason that we don't know about Matilda Jocelyn Gage is one of the most important stories about the women's rights movement, I think. In 1889, Susan B. Anthony engineered a merger between the more conservative American Women's Suffrage Association and the more radical National Women's Suffrage Association. It, in fact, brought in the Women's Christian Temperance Union, conservative Christian women who wanted to get the right to vote in order to put God in the Constitution, setting up a political test, a religious test in the country for the first time. If you would not swear allegiance to Christ as the head of the government, you could not hold political office in the United States of America. That was their vision. Matilda Jocelyn Gage said this is the greatest danger of the hour, this attempt to merge church and state. She tried to undo this merger because she saw it as the death of the progressive woman's movement, and she saw it moving in a very conservative, very dangerous to her direction. She was unable to undo that merger. She went on to form her own organization, an anti-church organization. Stanton initially said she'd be part of it. She said she was sick of the song of suffrage and that it was time to be about the real enemy of women, going after the church, which had set up the theoretical foundation that women must be subordinate to man, that woman is inherently evil, and that woman must obey. And those three teachings, both Gage and Stanton believed, were really at the foundation of woman's oppression, and that woman wouldn't be free until she got rid of those ideas. But Stanton then accepted the presidency of this new merged organization, the National American Women's Suffrage Association, and didn't go with Gage's group. Gage was really on her own at that point. She lost ties with the organized women's movement. She broke ties. But she also lost her friendships. She lost the people that she'd worked with for all these years, and she was absolutely right. The movement became more and more conservative, began making the argument, give women the right to vote, because white native-born women outnumber African-Americans, outnumber immigrants, and women's suffrage is a way to maintain white native-born supremacy. They began arguing racist and xenophobic arguments for giving women the right to vote. And Gage was not part of that movement. She continued to fight the church. In 1893, she wrote her major work, which talks about the sexual abuse of children and women by priests, by the clergy. It talks about the traffic in women. It talks about women getting unequal wages. Talks about women not being allowed into the clergy, not being allowed to define God. She talks about it was with the removal of the feminine, the removal of the female in the Godhead, the creation of an entirely male God, that the position of women became lower than it had ever been in the history of the world. As this movement became more and more conservative, Gage was more and more of an embarrassment with her beliefs that every religion that has existed upon the face of the earth has oppressed people, that the true religion is that which sets people free. She says, I will have nothing to do with this parody of religion that is the Christian church. She kept a vision of what true religion would be about, and she saw the manifestation of it in the church of her day as being the opposite of what true religion was. That in fact it had been the they called it the bulwark of slavery, because there was not a single church that spoke against slavery. They called it the bulwark of women's oppression because the churches were upholding the idea of women as being inferior, subordinate, that argument of St. Paul. So as she became more an embarrassment, the organized women's movement just simply wrote her out and wrote out that whole part of the history of the women's rights movement. Elizabeth Cady Stanton went on to write the Woman's Bible. Although she initially accepted the presidency of the National American Woman Suffrage Association, she remained a gadfly. And as it became more conservative, she troubled it more and more, letting them know how she felt about it. And finally, when she edited the Woman's Bible in 1895, the conservative movement dissociated themselves from her. One of my favorite Stanton stories is that on her 80th birthday, 1895, she was given the grandest birthday party one could ever imagine, the largest hall in New York City, and thousands of people came to pay tribute to her. This was the moment when the politic thing to do would have been to just gracefully and gratefully accept being honored. Instead, she got up and said, "Well, we're going to get the vote soon. That's a non-issue. What we really need to be about now is rewriting the Bible. The Bible isn't the Word of God. It was written by man out of his love of domination. And just as we've rewritten every other work of man when it has no longer met our needs, the Constitution, for example, we amend periodically, it's now time to take our pen to the Bible. And we need to remove the offending passages that have worked for the oppression of people." I love that she had the courage to do that and the grace. And I think she got written out to some extent the same way that Gage got totally written out. Now, the story of Matilda Jocelyn Gage and the writing out of her from history is the writing out of other important pieces of information, major pieces of information about our movement, the women's rights movement.
One piece of information Sally Rush Wagner gained from studying Matilda Jocelyn Gage was how early feminists were influenced by their First Nations neighbors in the Great Lakes region, people known as the Haudenosaunee, or the Six Nations of the Iroquois Confederacy.
Where did Matilda Jocelyn Gage, this foremost theoretician of the women's movement, the 19th century women's movement, where did she get her vision of what a transformed world would look like? It was so thorough, so complete. She said, every existing form of the institutions, church, family, capitalist, and state, rest on the oppression of women. And women will not be free until every existing form of those institutions is destroyed. How does a woman living at a time when she's not even able to attend college because every college and university is closed to women, where does this woman get such a vision? I knew from my experience in the women's movement that you didn't see from A to C without going through B. That when we began the movement, we narrowly could envision what rights would feel like, but we couldn't envision what it would look like to live in a world in which rights were no longer an issue, in which gender balance had been achieved for such a period of time, for generations, that people lived in the presence of it as a reality. Rights were as far as we could go. How did she get to balance without going through rights, was my question. She says in her major work, Woman, Church, and State, in talking about the Iroquois, the Six Nations of the Iroquois Confederacy, never was justice more perfect, never was civilization higher. And I knew that was a clue, but it wasn't until I got a National Endowment for the Humanities Fellowship and had 9 months to just study and contemplate that I had a chance to really look for an answer to the question that had troubled me. And what I did was to just simply inhale everything I could about the Iroquois. And I was in a, you know, working my study in Carmichael, California, not knowing if there were any of the Six Nations still existing, not knowing whether she knew what she was talking about. I started out with her sources, which she cites, and then went to who were her friends, who were the people she trusted, what had they read, what would they have seen, what did they write, what did they talk about. And what began as if I'm to be truthful, a real arrogant attitude of, oh, come on, What could Indian women have taught white women anyway? They were nothing but beasts of burden. And not recognizing that my own white supremacy, my own racism was so strong that it was not getting in the way of my scholarship. It was totally blocking it. It was not allowing me to even see the answer that was right in front of me. A humbling experience, to say the least. The result of that has been that I move very, very cautiously, very slowly. I figure that I'm most likely to get it wrong. That as a white scholar trying to understand another culture, the most likely scenario is that I'll do violence. So I didn't write anything, I think, for 8 years. I only wrote when traditional Iroquois people, Haudenosaunee people, asked me if I would write something. And at first all my publication was just in Native American publications. I thought if I get it right with them, which most of the time white people tell the story very, very wrong, then if I move slowly enough and get feedback enough, people will set me straight enough, then maybe I can tell a piece of the story. I can't speak to the experience of Haudenosaunee people. I can speak to what I see, and I can speak to research that I feel pretty proud of. I've looked at about 300 years of sources. I have thousands and thousands of pages of notes on the computer. I write only from a tiny fraction of what I have researched, but I want it to be as solid and as clear and as accurate as I can make it. What I think happened with the influence of the Iroquois is that the women whose eyes, ears, hearts were most open to hearing the possibility of another way of being saw women who lived with rights that you and I can hardly dream of today. They saw women who were responsible for choosing the representatives from the clan. The Grand Council is made up of representatives from each of the clan. So the authority for that representation rests with the women. The women nominate the chiefs. The women sit with the chiefs in council, inform the chiefs, and the clan mothers have the responsibility of removing the chief if he doesn't do what he should be doing. So they have, in some ways, a balance, but the women have an authority that's quite remarkable. The lineage is still, and it was in Gage and Stanton's time, lineage through the mothers. You are your clan because your mother is that clan. So if a mother died, or if the mother and father separated, the child always stays with the mother's clan. Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Matilda Jocelyn Gage lived in a time in which women had absolutely no rights to their own children. In fact, husbands could will away unborn child on a deathbed, and the child would be given to the rightful owner once the mother had birthed and finished nursing it. And the mother had no legal recourse. But they knew women who had absolute sovereignty of their own bodies. And interestingly, Stanton talks about the sovereignty of your own body. Not women should have rights to control their own bodies. Women should be absolute sovereigns of their own bodies. That's a very different concept. And it's a concept that really makes sense in Native American political terms, in terms of sovereign nations, that sort of being absolute authority of your own being. They knew women who, well, and here we get the connections. Matilda Jocelyn Gage was arrested for voting in her own village in Fayetteville, New York, having worked for 40 years to get women the right to vote. She was arrested for attempting to vote in a school board election. The same year, she was adopted into the Wolf Clan of the Mohawk Nation and given a say in the choosing of the chief. Did this connection make an impact on her. It's hard to imagine that it didn't. Elizabeth Cady Stanton was called a heretic because she said that women should be able to leave loveless and dangerous marriages. And the church's position was that marriage was a covenant with God. It was not an institution created by human beings, so therefore it could never be severed, even if the woman's life was at stake. And she talks about divorce Indian style, which is that the woman just puts the man's belongings outside of the longhouse. She says, you know, if he behaves inappropriately, he's gone. And she speaks with some amazement at that. She was called a savage for having birthed a 10-pound daughter and getting up immediately afterwards and being out the next day. And she said, strange, isn't it, that only Christian women suffer in childbirth, and then goes on to describe the birthing process for Native American women. It goes on and on and on like this. The first women to wear a reform costume rather than corseting their waist to 18 inches, dying in childbirth because they had displaced all their vital organs. Dress reform was really a matter of life and death. Dress reform in the 19th century to get rid of corsets was like health reform in the 20th century, getting rid of anorexia, women dying for fashion then and now in different ways, but it's the same issue. And Elizabeth Cady Stanton was a great health and dress reformer, very strongly committed to it, and talks about the vitality and the strength of Indian women. And she also talks about the need to dress differently. Her cousin was one of the first to wear a reform costume, which was women wearing tunics, you know, sort of slightly fitted dresses, short dresses, and then leggings. The very first costume was not trousers, it was leggings. Leggings as leggings are worn by Iroquois women. Now, where did white women get the idea to wear leggings? Where did they get the idea that women might have healthier bodies if they dressed differently? Perhaps it was partly at least through seeing women who in fact had healthier bodies because they did dress comfortably and adopting a dress very similar to theirs. So in terms of voting, in terms of birthing, in terms of health, in terms of a number of issues, I think that these suffragists, these women's rights advocates, were influenced by their closest neighbors, the Six Nations of the Iroquois Confederacy. They did have direct contact. Lucretia Mott came to Seneca Falls to plan that first women's rights convention from Cattaraugus, the Seneca Nation. She had been there with the Friends meeting that she was part of, a place there where they were educating the Seneca, and she spent time there. She watched the strawberry ceremony. She watched women take part in the political decisions that were going on, and that's the energy with which she came to Seneca Falls or Waterloo when they planned that first convention. Elizabeth Cady Stanton had a cousin named for an Indian chief. Peter Skenandoah Smith was named for a close friend of the family, Chief Skenandoah of the Oneida Nation. Matilda Jocelyn Gage was adopted, as I said, into the Wolf Clan of the Mohawk Nation, wrote extensively about the Iroquois and the superior position of women among the Iroquois, and she was in fact working on a book on the Iroquois at the time of her death. Unfortunately, that manuscript doesn't survive.
Although the works of Matilda Jocelyn Gage would be largely unread after her death, her vision of an ideal world would become quite popular through an odd twist of fate.
Matilda Jocelyn Gage's youngest daughter, Maud, clearly her favorite. She was a good mother, loved all her children, but little Maudie was everyone's favorite, the unexpected child that comes 10 years after the other children have all begun to grow. And Maud went to college, as her mother had been unable to do. In fact, Maud went to Cornell, as her brother Thomas Clarkson had done, because Matilda Jocelyn Gage helped open the doors of Cornell University to women. Maud comes home. Well, Maud plans to graduate from Cornell and then go on to law school. She comes home from college Christmas of her sophomore year, and tells her mother that she's dropping out of school to marry an itinerant actor. Her mother says, "No daughter of mine shall marry an itinerant actor." And Maud says, "Then we shall elope, mother." Gage looks at her. Matilda Jocelyn Gage looks at this child who is as willful as she is, who is really the mirror of her, and just collapses with laughter. And they both end up laughing and realizing their wills are perfectly matched. And Gage says, "Well, of course, I'll give you your wedding." And Maud says, "Oh, I know you would." And but Matilda is really very concerned because this son-in-law, while she loves him dearly, he's just a sweetheart, can't keep a job. I mean, he's an actor because his father indulges him, rich father indulges him anything he wants. He wants to be an actor, so his father buys him a theater, essentially. And he goes from one thing to another, and he just, you know, bankruptcy is not something that's unknown to him. She finally says to him, "You know, you should write down those stories that you tell the boys that they love so much," because the children would just come from, when he was coming back, he was actually a traveling salesman selling china on the road, he'd come home and the neighbor kids would gather and his own boys would be asking for stories. Well, this is a story of Listen to Your Mother-in-Law, because the year after Matilda Jocelyn Gage died, her son-in-law did follow her advice, and L. Frank Baum published The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, which has, of course, if you read all 14 of the Oz books, it is the matriarchy that Matilda Jocelyn Gage writes about as the prehistoric golden age of women, when female energy, female will, female vision reigns supreme. The spiritual leader of Oz is Glinda. The political leader of Oz is Ozma, and Dorothy is sort of the temporal everywoman, the common sense girl who gets herself out of every jam and everybody else as well. She is the, I think, prairie girl. His nieces, he had no daughters, L. Frank Baum and Maud had no daughters, loved their nieces, and their nieces all lived in North Dakota or South Dakota on the prairies. They were just strong-willed prairie girls. I did hours of taping with Matilda Jewel Gage, who was the granddaughter, the namesake, and the only living grandchild at the time of Matilda Jocelyn Gage. She remembered her grandmother, went to her funeral when she was 12. And the voice of Matilda Jewel Gage in those tapes is very much the voice of Up and Adam Dorothy. I think that he really took the voice of his nieces as the voice of Dorothy.
And I think it's terribly important to point out the suppression of that work, so talk about that a bit.
It's very hard to find a library today that has an original set of Oz books. Partly it's that people have found the value of them. You know, a first edition of The Wizard of Oz now could put your kids through college almost, but, well, maybe not quite that, but the other reason is that in the 1950s, the books were censored. During the McCarthy era, they were censored because in Oz, everyone gets what they need, and everyone gives what they can. There are no rich, there are no poor in Oz. There are no churches in Oz. And his idea of a utopia was Joseph McCarthy's idea of communism, the terrible enemy. And so during the 50s, in fact, the books were removed from the shelves, and many libraries today have only now restocked their shelves with newer editions of the Oz books.
Sally Rush Wagner talked with Elaine Clift during the 150th anniversary celebration of the Seneca Falls Women's Rights Convention, a gathering whose aims have not all been achieved even today.
The uncanny similarities between the rise of the religious right in the 1890s and the rise of the religious right 100 years later say to me that to honor the memory of Matilda Jocelyn Gage and to continue her work is to continue to fight against the conservative teachings of the church in regard to women. When the Baptists just recently came out with a reaffirmation of the very ideas that Gage was fighting 100 years ago, saying this is the foundation of woman's oppression, I hear her voice saying, the work is not yet done.
Sally Roche Wagner died June 11, 2025. One of her legacies was preserving the home of Matilda Jocelyn Gage, now a museum and center for social justice dialogue in Fayetteville, New York. Wings thanks Elaine Clift for that interview. Thanks also to your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose books include Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings Sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Since its inception in 2022, CFRC Power Plays has become the number one destination for all things Queens football.
And that is a touchdown for the Gales!
With over 50 million lifetime views, CFRC Power Plays is the defining voice in Queens football coverage.
Looking for Nico Cuomo! Cuomo! My goodness! Nico Cuomo with a touchdown!
Follow us today on Instagram at CFRC Power Plays, your number one spot for rock solid football action.